for a while. If
okay.
If my answer is not boil downable into something for you, you would do me a service by telling me that rather than smiling politely. Yeah. I run into this mostly on the phone. Somebody will ask a question, and the question, it will take me 10 minutes to answer the question, but then it's a newspaper, so the person has to kind of boil the question down to like 50 words, answer down.
Right.
And particularly if I haven't slept much, I'm more prone to doing that. But what I'm just saying to you is you don't need to be polite if you need to say, that made no sense to me, or I can't use okay. this, can we try again?
Okay.
I'd be happy to. I won't be offended.
All right. I'll do that. Let me just make sure this is...
Let me ask
you. Okay.
Quit. Like you couldn't remember your name or your social security number. No? You don't have to pretend.
I don't remember. Well...
Some people get angry.
I remember being very anxious, actually, that I wouldn't be able to write.
Yeah. There's that, too.
Because of the need to concentrate. But mostly I just remember being amazed by the fact that the thing smelled.
Yeah. No, there are plus sides to it. Food gets a lot more interesting. But
did you just quit recently?
No, I just quit in June. But, I don't seem to be able to... I'm not snapping back well.
Uh-huh.
And I'm developing a vicious dependence on these nicotine patches, which are very expensive. So.
Is that on the record, the smoking? No?
I don't care.
You don't care? Okay.
Oh, okay. If it's something...
Like if you have...
Yeah.
Ground rules.
I don't imagine being embarrassed about having... I doubt it's really all that compelling to watch Club Readers.
No, I'm just like, if I'm setting the scene.
No, that's kind of you. I think if I start saying something and then think that perhaps it would be better if it weren't in the article, I'll say off the record.
Okay.
You seem like a trustworthy young man.
Yeah, no, if you ask me to do that,
okay.
It's not a...
Because our paths will cross again.
You're not a politician. I'm
okay.
Just let me know. So, I guess I should start with just the basic, biographical stuff. How old are you? Where do you live now? What are you doing?
I'm 41 years old. I lived for a really long time in Central Illinois. A year ago, I moved to Southern California because I got a job.
Okay.
It's actually a coincidence that I'm wearing it. But
uh-huh.
And I live in the vicinity of that college, which is
okay.
about... It's halfway between LA and San Bernardino.
Okay.
So it seems very brisk and autumnal here too.
It is. And so you're teaching.
Uh-huh.
What are you teaching?
I teach in the English department. I got hired to teach writing, but they're also letting me teach some literature classes.
What kind of literature?
I've taught only one last. Spring did a just a kind of eclectic modern. Did Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children, and Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays, and Richard Brautigan's In Watermelon Sugar.
Uh-huh.
Kind of books that are big, but you know college students are never going to get them in a class. So,
uh-huh.
No, it's a good school.
Are you going to teach that class again this year, or are you?
I'm teaching an introductory workshop this fall and in the spring. This is one reason I took the job is it's just one class a semester.
Nice.
Yeah. and in the spring I'm teaching an advanced composition, like essay writing class.
Essay writing?
Uh-huh.
Nonfiction?
Yeah.
And will you be having them read stuff for that as well, or is it all mostly practical?
I think so, probably. I think that class is going to be set up. It'll be a little bit experimental. It'll be a little bit like a fiction workshop, only with nonfiction. But I imagine, I don't know if you've taken workshops, you usually read some outside stuff at the beginning, if only to kill time, while they begin generating their own stuff for the workshop. But
uh-huh.
Imagine we'll read some stuff. I've just about every magazine I read now, I come upon one thing or another, and I think, well, that'll be really good for the essay class, and so I'll bookmark it and put it on a special shelf. I don't know, man, how many of the things will
happen. Anything in particular?
Oh, golly. What is the last? Probably the last thing that I bookmarked. There's a magazine that's come out recently called The Believer on the West Coast. They have it in New York, too. There's an article in the latest one, and I can't think whom it's by, but it's about American corporations, particularly converted munitions factories, being involved in high fructose corn syrup. And the basic argument is that have you seen this article?
No, I haven't. I've read about high fructose corn syrup.
Well, yeah, no. What's interesting is that this makes a very complicated kind of leftist argument about corporate villainy and American obesity, which I imagine is indebted to Fast Food Nation in certain ways, but it's very quick, and I think it would be interesting to put that across from an article in, I don't know, the American Spectator or something very, very conservative, and have them read this is argumentatively it's weak, but politically it's interesting because it's an ideological rant is what it is, and I think it'd be interesting to put a left and a right. Anyway, I don't know. Do I want any of that not in the... I don't know. I'm too tired.
I'm really just sort of curious what kind of things you would ask them to read.
For a class like this, you would start out... You basically tell them about the different modes, right? Like descriptive essays. I don't know. Virginia Woolf's Death of a Moth and maybe some John McPhee or something. Mm. How old are you? Do you know John McPhee?
I know who he is, but I haven't actually.
What are you, about early 30s? Yeah, okay. Big New Yorker writer in the 70s and 80s. And some Diddy. And then you do some argumentative, and then you do some meditative, more like the think piece. Oh, Louis Menand had a thing in the New Yorker about the scholarly boilerplate at the end of term papers and how to do footnotes. That also talks about that annoying paperclip icon in the new Microsoft. But I think that's the last one that I'm for sure I want them to read.
Really?
As an example, you can write about like anything. Like their own term papers and the tribulations of doing their footnotes can become interesting essays. So, I mean, it's just 30 things like that.
Right.
But probably not stuff out of textbooks or anything. Right. It's not a short answer, I'm sorry.
No. I was thinking, it's interesting that you're teaching now. Because this book has a lot of sort of a teaching voice to it.
Good segue.
How does that feel to be talking that way rather than storytelling?
Good question. This book is a piece of technical writing, and it's a piece of pop technical writing, meaning it's not for a specialized audience. So I don't... it's real different. At least when you're teaching humanities classes, the teaching is much more in the form of a conversation. Whereas this is, you're sort of kind of, let's see, trying to take somebody up on an elevator at the same time you're building the shaft around them. So that there's parts of this. In the book, it will say, now we need to teach you the following four things so you will understand this. And at least in the classes that I teach, it's never that overt. Because it's a liberal arts school and the whole, I don't know what kind of school you went to, but they're big into you teach the students to think. Mm-hmm. You don't deliver information. So it's a different, it's interesting. It's a different form of teaching. The other difference is that apparently they're going to do a whole series of books like these. I think Sherwin Newland already had one that came out in this series.
Yeah, there's one other about antibiotics or something.
Yeah, and childbed fever. They've got a real specific agenda for this series, and you might want to talk to Jesse Cohen about it, but I know having people who aren't professionals in the field that they're writing about is a big part of the agenda. And some of that, at least, I think is supposed to decrease the degree of teaching in the book or the degree of condescension. This is not, you know, a professional mathematician talking to lay people. This is a lay person who spent some time noodling about this stuff talking to other lay people. Mm-hmm. So it's rather more collegial than a standard teaching situation.
Yeah.
But they do. If you want background for the article, Jesse's a mensch, and he's also this was almost 2 years ago that he kind of gave me the spiel on the series. They've got a whole kind of idea for how they want to do it.
Did they come to you, or did you go to them, or was this a book you've been hoping to write for a while?
No, they came to me. The way they do these series, I think, is they try to book writers ahead of time to do it. I think they've got a whole list of other ones that they're going to do. No, I was in Texas working on something and got this fax from my agent, who knew that I'm sort of have an amateur interest in this kind of stuff, and dilly-dallied with them for a while about the fine points of it. Originally, I was going to do a book on Kurt Gödel and incompleteness theorems, which is a lot more heavy math-wise, and it became pretty obvious that I actually had some courses in set theory. At least some parts of this book are stuff I actually know something about, whereas the girdle, I would have been pulling a lot of it out of my bottom.
Okay.
So somebody else is doing, I think they got somebody else who's doing the girdle who actually was like with him and, well, whatever.
Wow. Okay.
I'm too tired to flog the series. You should talk to Jesse though, because there's a whole context for this book that isn't part of the books I normally do, and I don't know that much about it.
Tell me more about your background with math. Like, how much did you do, and what did it mean to you?
I didn't do all that much. In college, I was an English major and a philosophy major, and the philosophy I was interested in was mostly mathematical logic and semantics, which is a really, it turns out it's a very high-level kind of math. But you don't need Calc 1, Calc 2, Calc 3, Calc 4 to do it. It doesn't proceed pyramidically like a lot of math. But if you do a lot in math logic, you pick up a whole lot about the history of math, and particularly some of the, there's a whole branch of philosophy called philosophy of mathematics that has to do with deduction, weaknesses in deduction, and what Cantor's paradox and Gödel's incompleteness theorems did to math. And I'd ended up one summer, not in college, but at the town that I lived in, there was a university taking a summer school class that actually was about set theory, because it was something I was interested in working on for my thesis as an undergraduate. So
this was like between years in college.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it was for you in college. I would go home every summer, and home for me is where the University of Illinois is, and they have this huge math and philosophy department, and but that was 1983, so it's a long time ago. Is that a halfway clear answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess I'm sort of wondering, like, is math something? I guess the other part is, what did it mean to mean? Why? What was your original attraction to it? I mean, it's unusual to put it together with being a fiction writer. So I just wonder.
Well. I think of myself primarily as a fiction writer, but I do nonfiction sometimes, and I'm interested in it. Because I'm tired, I'll just tell you the truth, and you can make the sense of it. I taught for a long time at a school called Illinois State. Two offices down from me was a guy who taught tech writing, which I never quite understood what that was. Do you know what it is?
I can hazard a guess. But
what would be your guess?
Just writing about technical stuff, right?
But kind of. But it's really, it's everything from, writing training manuals for new, like, Dell employees, to writing the pamphlets that come with your new laptop, to writing instructions about how to put your child's swing set together, to, books like this, science, Oliver Sacks, writing about neurology, or that man Green's book about string theory. Is it Brian Green or Stephen Green?
I think it's Brian.
And it turns out it's a whole continuum, and it's really about how to communicate clearly about specialized stuff with a particular audience. And it gets, I never took this guy's class, but there's nothing to do in your office usually, because nobody ever came to my office hours, so I'd listen to this guy. It's really about how to be clear and how to figure out whom your audience is. Probably anybody who's not really gifted at computers and has tried to load software or home fix or receive, like, what is it called? TI, technological information help from one of these helplines, learns very quickly that tech writing is actually very hard. It's very hard, particularly for somebody with any expertise, to be clear. Number one, clear. Number two, interesting to somebody who isn't, but simply needs some quantum of information delivered to them in order to be able to do something. And I got interested in it. I got interested in it partly because it's heavily rhetorical, like in the old Greek sense. There are different kinds of appeals, some of which are emotional, some of which are rational. And it's heavily, this is going to sound really academic. It involves speculations about what your discourse community is. I can tell from your eyebrows that you're not going to use any. Figuring out whom your audience is, uh-huh. Right? For instance, to do this book, I ended up having to read about 50 other books. Some were for mathematicians, and some were all the way down to, you know, like David Berlinsky's Tour of the Calculus, which is supposed to be that's a pop tech book about calculus, and it ended up being very interesting to me. I'd never done anything like that per se, but I'd ended up, when you teach writing, you end up speaking with your students a whole lot about how to be clear, how to realize that your reader can't read your mind, and that though this proposition that you've uttered here might be clear to you, what it is on the page isn't clear, and the whole idea of number one, of how to be clear, and number two, how to take something that's very abstract but that is beautiful to you. This stuff is, though I'm not an expert in it, I had enough in it, this stuff is really beautiful. There's an austere kind of crystalline beauty to math and formal systems. How, in tech writing, to a popular audience, number one, to communicate clearly enough about it so they've got some idea what's going on, and number two, to get them in some way to feel what's beautiful about it, seemed to me to be a really kind of interesting project. The other part is I thought I could knock it off very quickly. I thought I could do it in like 6 months, and it ended up taking a lot longer than that. But, I mean, that's okay, but that's the other reason that I decided to do it. I'll just take 6 months off. And fiction's a pain in the ass anyway. I'll just do this. So use what of that.
Okay. you did a review in Science a couple years ago.
You've done your homework, yeah.
And you took those writers to task for not having thought through who their audience
was.
That's
right. That's exactly when I started noodling about this. That's when I was starting to do the first note-taking for this book.
Yeah. I guess...
I mean, they're really dreadful books. The ones I read... It's not just a mean review. They're really, really...
No, they looked quite... I mean, I didn't look at the books, but...
The one in particular, was it The Wild Numbers? I mean, no offense to the writer, who I'm sure is, you know, kind to animals and stuff. But one reason it was bad is that it would take time to define very simple stuff like addition, but then would throw around really sort of high level math terms that there's no way that the same person who would need very simple stuff defined wouldn't need that stuff defined. And so you could the books were very interesting to read in that way.
Well, so how did you address those problems in writing your book?
It's so much more fun criticizing how other people did it. There was another book about Cantor came out probably about a year before I started working on this by this guy Amir Axel, who a lot of people know, I think, for a book about Fermat's Last Theorem. That was a book a lot more about Cantor's mental illness and certain supposed connections between infinity and mental illness and infinity and the Kabbalah. A fine book, nothing wrong with it. but obviously I wanted to do something different. And the something different here, the only way that I could think of to do it would be to talk about where this actually came from. I mean, Cantor's transfinites and set theory didn't just all of a sudden pop up. It came out of, well, I don't know how much of this you've read. It comes out of a really, really specific context involving both the definition of irrational numbers and something called the uniqueness theorem for infinite series of functions. Mm-hmm. Those terms don't mean anything, but if the book works, if you read the book, they do, because you find out where those problems came from and what their history is and who had worked on them. And so the book is meant to be kind of a twin scaffold. Number one, it proceeds more or less historically, starting with the Greeks from infinity, and number two, it proceeds kind of conceptually, so that we're talking about things like abstractions and integers at the beginning, and when calculus is invented, and there are the problem of infinitesimals, which is when it becomes clear that infinity is an issue that math is going to have to grapple with rigorously at some point, although they did a heroic job of putting it off for like 270 years. So there's, you know, 5 or 6 pages of thumbnail, either intro or refresher on what basic calc is. So if it works, it's kind of a twin tower structure. Well, what one tower or pyramid proceeding historically and the other proceeding more or less conceptually. That's why there are the little...
Okay.
Sorry, reader, we have to do a little emergency glossary thing.
Right.
Now, you sort of... What's the thing? Is it last-minute availability, last-minute use? There's this new thing in business where inventory...
Just-in-time
inventory. And I remember reading a business article about that just when I was sort of outlining for this and thinking that might be, because you can't simply give the reader, the first half of the book is all the conceptual ammo you need, mm-hmm. because then the reader's eyes will be glazed over. It will seem like a math class, only much less satisfying because much faster, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you can build it such that you create a context where, oh, I understand, I'm going to need to know a little bit how calculus works in order to understand what infinitesimals are. Oh, by the way, here's this glossary thing on calculus. Now, I'm talking about what the design was. Whether or not it worked is another matter. I mean, I don't know. A couple people have already said to me, gosh, good book, but it's really hard, thinking that's a compliment, and it's not a compliment to me. It's not supposed to be hard.
So what were your expectations for the reader? That it wouldn't be hard?
Well, I don't know about hard. I mean, harder than, you know, reading, like, like a Scott Turow book at the beach. It's a different thing. But the idea is, if the book works right, it teaches you exactly the stuff you need to know to have at least a general lay grasp of what's going on and sort of be able to get a picture of the terrain. And so to finish it with a better idea, not just of how Cantorian transfinite set theory works, but actually why it was a big deal, where it came from, and why it's kind of beautiful and amazing, rather than just asserting this is beautiful and amazing and mathematicians are amazed by it, which it's fairly easy just to assert that.
Right.
To try to get the reader to feel it at all, even just a little bit, just to feel, holy shit, uh-huh. holy cow, this is what this is why this was a big deal, this is why he started working on this, this was the problem, here's the way that he took the little digression. Again, now I'm talking about the program. I've now looked at the thing so many times I don't know whether it works or not,
right?
So and you're being very tactful about whether you've even read it, so it doesn't
matter. I have read it I have read it.
Does it seem halfway clear to you?
Parts of it do, parts of it lost me.
Like where?
Well, the beginning, obviously the first, like, 75 pages. When we get into...
The first 75 pages lost?
No. Those I follow. The interesting thing was that I was okay, then I get lost, and then I'm okay again. That once you get into the actual infinity, once you get past... I couldn't really follow.
So calc, differential equations.
Here's what I got lost. I got lost with the uniqueness theorem.
Yeah.
I got lost with point sets, derived sets of limit points.
It's the hardest part of the book.
One place where you're doing derived sets of derived, you know, first series derived sets, second series derived
That's
sets
right.
of limit points.
Yeah.
In order to prove that two trigonometric Fourier series are the same.
Yep.
And you do this thing where you've got...
Or their sum is the same function. They collapse to the same function. Yeah.
Right.
That's how...
I had trouble keeping those two distinctions.
Well, and again, this isn't going to be for the article, but the idea is that The idea is, does any particular trigonometric function expand to its own unique series? If you can show that all the different series that a function expands to are equivalent, then it is just one series. I mean, that's the idea. But you know what? You're a smart cookie. That's exactly the hardest part of the book.
Here's the problem I had. You do this thing where you're kind of going up, and you derive the sets, and like a certain number are infinite, and then you get to one that's finite, and then that's after that, it's the null set.
Well, it's finite because of the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem and the maximum minimum number of points in a point set around a limit. But that was from 60 pages ago
Here's the problem that I had. Like going up, some of them are infinite, some of them are finite, and then there's one at zero. And then you do this thing where you go back down and try and you sort of say, but since this one's zero, actually they're all zero. And I was like, wait a minute, but a page ago,
now
there was something in those sets.
Fair enough. Do you really want to talk about it?
I'm curious.
I mean, what it is the second series, I think it's the second series, at some point you reach a finite set. Because of the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, that at some point any collection of points involving a limit, which a point set involves limits, because that's what makes the set. It's all the sets, it's all the points around a certain point, and that point functions as the limit. Any limited set is at some point has its absolute minimum quantity on the curve for the set. If you were going to graph the curve, it would take its absolute minimum. The absolute minimum for a set is the null set. Anything that yields the... It's true. The absolute minimum for a set is the null set.
So the function is the set.
Well, no, because what we're talking about is the two infinite series, right, that diverge at a certain number of exceptional points. Remember the exceptional point singularity thing?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
The big deal with uniqueness, Riemann had already proved that two infinite series were equivalent if they diverged at a finite number of points. But what Cantor's uniqueness theorem says is even if these, and it's really, I mean, it doesn't intuitively make some sense. How can they be the same? He shows they can be the same. Even with an infinite number of exceptional points, they're functionally equivalent. The way he does that is to distinguish between two different kinds of derived sets of that set of singularities. And if the derived sets, if all the derived sets stay infinite, they're two different series. But if at any point they're second series and one becomes finite, because of the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, at some point it takes its minimum function, which is the null set. It's empty. Anything that produces the empty set, the set before it has got to be finite, and it at some point takes its absolute. See, I'm still not.
But when you were going for, when you were going up, doing that process, those sets had points in them.
Because
then you go back, it turns out
again,
that they don't. That's what
the overall point is. You have identified for me what I think is the shakiest part of the book, and the part of the book that I think is hardest to understand, that I actually considered cutting, but if I really am supposed to give the whole story of where this came from, these are infinite sets, but Cantor distinguishes between two kinds. The kind that produce infinite derived sets, an infinite number of infinite derived sets, and the kind that produce only a finite number of infinite sets, and at some point the derived sets become finite. The minute they become finite, to put it in a nutshell, you can, with only a little bit of legal maneuvering with the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, you can then go back down.
Okay. I think you were.
Well, if that's the only part of the book that seemed really, really hard, I don't feel too bad, because I think that section says three or four times, this will be over in a second.
Right.
I know this seems really abstract. I, off the record, this was the part that I was weakest on. I never really understood it all that well in set theory class. Now we're back on the record.
Okay, tell me when we're on the record.
Well, no, because I mean, the publisher will kill me if I start talking about, that's the weakest part of the book, and that's the part of the book I understood least well. All the stuff that's in the book is, I mean, that's correct, Mm-hmm. But there isn't a fantastic way of describing it, and I couldn't find one that wouldn't have taken 60 or 70 more pages. And the thing is, I can't spend 35 pages on the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, which is really what you need to intuitively understand how you get from a finite set to the null set, and why the reverse-derived set of that then becomes finite and the dropping back down.
Yeah.
Because the book was already like 100 pages over the word limit.
This is what was interesting for me as a reader, is after that page, pretty much, I follow everything.
Yeah.
You know? And I wondered if I needed it. I mean, I understood that was the problem that Cantor was trying to solve, but actually all of the things Cantor figures out, I could follow. Me could follow.
So my fondest hope is that the average reader has more or less your experience. My worry about that section is that professional mathematicians are going to be bothered by simplifications in that, and non-professionals are going to be lost. And I only hope that the three or four times in here I say, this is the hardest part of the book, this will be over quickly, I know this looks weird. The point of the book is I wanted to provide the context. This is where it came from. Is the stuff about why the uniqueness theorem was a big deal, and why all the stuff coming out of Fourier series and Dirichlet and Riemann, was all that stuff kind of hazy too, or did that more or less make sense?
Well, I have to confess that when I took Calc, Fourier series were my weak point.
Oh, they're hard. And notice, the book doesn't do a whole lot with them.
So that section I was a little shaky on.
Between you and me, there needs to be another 30 pages on the move from infinite series of quantities to infinite series of functions. It's done very fast in the second emergency glossary, and there just wasn't enough room, and there needs to be either more or less on the derivation of the uniqueness theorem. I don't know if that's... You know what, I'm not going to say off the record, because unless you're writing a 10,000-word article, it's not going to show up in the newspaper, but you've put your... For me as the author, I think those are the two places where the book is shaky. There are other places where I think, though, that it really kind of does work. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to get back to your question. I'm hoping that a reader, even a reader who hasn't had, say, a semester of college math, will be able to follow enough of it to get why this stuff was a big deal, and to get why it was pretty in a more substantive way than just another one of these books, you know, a madman in an institution,
right,
created, you know, this heavy duty concept. It would be good probably not to have too much stuff about busting on other people's books, because that's just... not that there was anything wrong with that other book. Have you read that other book?
No, I haven't.
It's really not that bad.
All right. Let's see. There's
But perhaps as an intellectual exercise, and again,
yeah,
this is assuming you don't have a deadline or something. Were one theoretically to want to take a look at a book that this book was very much reacting against? Like, here might be a book that's wanting to do this in a kind of more honest, less patronizing way, theoretically, to the reader. That other nameless book might be an interesting book to look at if you sort of want to see my justification for some of the parts of the book that are hard, is at least it's not just giving the reader pablum, you know, and abetting certain really romantic but kind of flabby ideas about madness and genius and certain mathematical concepts being so forbidden that they drive people crazy, which hypothetically is utter horseshit.
Yeah.
Utter marketing, let's make this sexy horseshit.
I found that
shit, fuck, shit. none of it can be used.
Not in a family newspaper. I found that really interesting, the parts where you're sort of taking issue with that.
I think it's very quickly, at the beginning, it shows mammoth restraint.
Yeah,
but partly because what reader's interested? I mean, who wants to wade through at the start of a book 40 pages of about another book? But it was actually very galvanizing for me. There are good pop math books. This hypothetical one I'm referring to is not such a book.
But see, I think, well, I think it relates to a tension that is within your book, which is, it's different, but this tension between infinity, you talk about an answer being technically correct versus really sort of appreciating it.
Sure.
And
you mean in reference to Zeno's paradox?
In reference to Zeno's paradox, but you come back to it again and again, the sort of first-year calc answer isn't, it's correct, but it isn't enough. It's semi-impoverished, you say.
And you can see, given this hypothetical other book I'm reacting against, I want to make sure that I don't just say, well, no, there's not enough actual calculus, because that a lot of that is specious, too. And I don't know whether your math experiences were the same as mine, but there's a reason for it. Math classes aren't like English classes. There are concepts that need to be digested and regurgitated on exams, and many people need this stuff to go on to other stuff, but they never tell you anything about why this is important or where it came from or why exactly quantities have to be, you know, finite through 90% of the equation, then all of a sudden you make them infinitesimals. They don't tell you that. And in the context of the math class, I think the book's maybe a little unfair, and I think I'm working out some of my own anger. I was very frustrated in college math classes because they just wouldn't tell you why this stuff was important. Within the pedagogical context of the math class, that makes sense. But, for instance, if you ever had Zeno's dichotomy or even Achilles and the tortoise in a calc class and you saw the calc solution, you don't walk away bathed in relief at the resolution to the paradox, because they strip all the interesting context away, show you a formula that you can deploy, but they don't tell you where the formula came from. Was this something they cooked up just to solve this paradox? Or is this formula, in Hardy's term, interestingly connected to other math concepts anyway?
Okay. No, I'm just making sure the tape
is
still...
Okay.
But I would counter that, though, is that... in a way, what math does is just come up with the technical correct answer and take away... Because you talk about how there's this sort of growth cycle of a paradox being discovered, and then there's kind of this maximal containment. You talk about sort of hygiene and trying to keep it away. Mm-hmm. And then eventually somebody says, well, let's just find out what the rules of the paradox are and see how it works. So, but in effect, what you're saying by sort of... Isn't there a tension between sort of being suspicious of the technically correct answer and what is math's achievement, which is to find the technical correct answer and to pretend that the paradox isn't so mysterious after all?
You're right. Yes, there's a way that math is about diffusing these paradoxes, but serious mathematicians never regarded Zeno's paradoxes as, oh, this is just a fallacy. This is just something that would only fool. How to put this? I mean, what happens is Zeno's paradoxes are galvanizing to math, right? Because it's I mean, I don't know whether your readers, right? You're going to leave the room. Before you get all the way out of the room, you got to get halfway. You can summarize it, right? It's obvious there's something wrong with it. But how do you articulate what's wrong with it? Right?
Mm-hmm.
You try it in natural language, it doesn't work very well. All right? The way to explain it is, this is one of the few times where it seems to me mathematics is actually useful. What's actually going on here? Well, this is actually a series. This is a geometric series. Right? Now, it seems to me that at that point, if you're just given A over 1 minus R as the formula in a math class, I'd say that's semi-impoverished. Okay, I can solve that, but I still don't understand how I walked out of the room. But if you then begin talking about, well, how exactly, why is it that an infinite series can have a finite sum? Can we make sense of that mathematically? Can we connect that with all kinds of other stuff? And can we do it rigorously? Which is, right, that's the big deal in math, is that there's not supposed to be room for paradox, because you start with axioms and you've got codified derivation rules and everything. It's the perfect legal system, right? Why is this okay? Look at item 1A, 7C, 2D. We use these two formation rules. It's there's no haze. There's not supposed to be any fuzz. But these paradoxes, of course, drive math crazy, because not only is it an insoluble problem, but it begins to cast doubt on the apodictic, the deductive method. So it's in math's interest to diffuse these, and sometimes I think math does it. I mean, I think the book talks about it. The easy way for math to do it is to run that kind of specious reductio, right? Anything that yields a paradox, therefore there's got to be something wrong with the premises. But to expand math, which is what Weierstrass is able to do, right? Weierstrass is able to talk about why one is the sum of that series, 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8, or why one is the limit of the sequence, 1/2, is able to do it without using approaches or comes arbitrarily close or any of that natural language stuff. Weierstrass is able to take it right out of...
Is he the epsilon guy?
Yeah, epsilonic proof. Right out of the basic rules about integers and all. And that's why for math this is... Okay. Now we can diffuse this in a way where we don't have to, like, fudge and start using these weird English... What exactly does it mean to come arbitrarily, to come infinitely close to a limit? What does that look like mathematically? I mean, it's a head game. And it's why, at least for me, Calc 1 was such... You're supposed to be finishing this timed exam, but they're asking you to swallow things that don't make any sense according to the very rules they've set up, right? Something's either zero or it isn't, right? Yeah. But now, for the purposes of this, that's what's annoying about a regular math class. They say this is going to be very clean. There's no room for fuzz. Oh, but in order to solve this problem, we need a little bit of fuzz here. I don't know, whatever.
Well, I think,
So did I answer the question? There is the tension, but I think the tension is stark in a math class. And to be fair to a math class, Calc 1 is not philosophy of math, right?
Right.
I happen to think it would serve the students better to slow down a little bit, explain a little bit about where this came from and where this formula came from, so that. The student learned it in here instead of just having a formula to regurgitate. Their answer would probably be, well, math majors, by the time you get to fifth semester of math, you're starting to learn that. We proceed pyramidically. You're now really sorry you asked the question.
No. The flip side of that is that your sort of emphasis on the paradoxes, I had always taken irrational numbers as being sort of commonsensical. But I think your book actually convinced me that they can't possibly really exist. I don't know what I was thinking, accepting them as real. I had a whole identification with L. Kronecker. I thought, you know, maybe I'm an intuitionist, because now that he's sort of... There was something about...
What do you mean not real?
Cut. I just thought, well, maybe they just aren't real. I mean...
But by real, you mean mathematically real or physically real?
Physically real.
But are numbers physically real?
I had thought that they were in some way. But, I mean, this is a good thing that I got from your book.
So you're a bit of a Platonist, then.
Well, that was my next question to you. I guess I thought I was, but then I realized if I am, it's only for, it's only for integers, I guess. I don't know. I haven't thought this through.
We're brainwashed into being Platonists in elementary school because it's the easiest way to think about them, right? It's too... Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to tell a fourth grader the metaphysics of the integer 3, so we got this idea that 3 is this thing, and that we're manipulating things, but in fact, that's the first step of the math abstraction process. We're not manipulating things. We're manipulating certain symbols that stand absolutely generally for, I guess, the set of all triples in the world. And that's the thing, to me, that's really interesting about the book, is that, I mean, Cantorian set theory is about as esoteric as you get in math, but it also... It goes right to the very fundamental stuff about math, is that these are not things. These don't have very... even if you're a Platonist, that is, even if you believe that numbers are real in some kind of metaphysical sense, the way trees and Calebs are real, as opposed to mathematically real. I mean, I can't sum it up. I mean, you know, 70 pages of the book is spent noodling about this stuff.
Right.
Even if you're convinced of that, the reason we're convinced of it is that we never really think about it. Well, if they are, like, where are they? What do they look like? What is three? I mean, what it's much more like is the kind of speculations that little children, the questions little children have, or like adolescents who smoke a lot of pot at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Marlon Bain in Infinite Jest describes marijuana thinking. Do you remember that? The way you talk about vicious infinite regress in this book reminded it seems like you were describing the same thing.
Boy, you've done more homework than the average newspaper guy who comes to the hotel room. I mean, it's something I'm a little bit interested in, that the stuff that we lie in bed at night that seems to have nothing to do with our lives, that just drives us crazy, is actually, when you think about it, the really, 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 really basic stuff. What are numbers, and what exactly are these three dimensions we're sitting in, and stuff that it's embarrassing to talk about out loud, because it does. It just sounds like pot smoking, like but in some sense, this is what mathematicians, and back in the Greeks, philosophers, because there was no difference at the time, this is what they did. You know,
so
all the stuff we take for granted, they sort of had to sit there and go, you know.
So are you a Platonist? Do you think mathematical concepts exist?
How, if this is going to be in the article, how would you provide enough context for the question to make sense?
Well, that would be the challenge for them.
Personally, between you and me, yeah, I'm a Platonist. And I personally think that God has particular languages, and one of them is music, and one of them is mathematics. And that's not something I could defend. It's just something I felt like in my tummy since I was a little kid. But how exactly to try to make sense of that and fit it in any kind of something like a working philosophy, much less cross the street to buy a loaf of bread, is a different matter. In a certain sense, really, really, in the ultimate sense, it doesn't matter what I think. What the book is about is what, like, Cantor and Gödel thought. The fact that Kurt Gödel was a Platonist, when Gödel's incompleteness theorem